his new book, the writer Brad Ricca tells the story of a man named Philip Kaufman. Kaufman will grow up to be a famous film director and producer, but one day when he's just a kid, as Ricca tells it, he goes to get his teeth checked out.
For some reason, the dentist is obsessed with the Ark of the Covenant. And he tells him all these stories, and the kid's mouth is wide open. His hands are waving, telling all the powers of the Ark, and you can communicate with God and lay waste to the enemies of the Lord. And of course, it just sticks with Kaufman. And years later, he ends up in Los Angeles, and he's a film producer, and he goes on a walk with his friend George Lucas. And at this point, George had worked out the beginnings of the idea of his rogue archaeologist who was going to look all over the globe for adventure and fortune and glory, and his name was going to be Indiana Smith at that point. But George's problem was he didn't know what his hero was going to look for. It had to be the perfect object that would be interesting and mysterious and also kind of have a little bit of a hold in the real world. And at this point, Kaufman says, I know exactly what it should be. It should be the Ark of the Covenant. You know, the rest is cinematic history. He goes to Spielberg and he's all in. He, of course, makes the change to Indiana Jones. And they go on and do Raiders of the Lost Ark. It's my favorite film. And I think everybody has one that kind of gets its hooks in you when you're a kid and you can't let go of it. We were Star Wars kids. Star Wars was great, but Star Wars was absolutely fantasy. But Raiders had the Nazis, it had history. And at the middle of it, it had the Ark, this strange relic that the Bible talks about as being real, yet no one has seen it for thousands and thousands of years. And this makes it, of course, a perfect point of conjecture for the mysterious, for the uncanny. And I think that's what got me as a kid and kind of never let go.
So fast forward a few years, several years actually, Brad Ricca has written a book about the actual historical expedition to find the Ark of the Covenant. This was in 1909. Now, it's not exactly the story in the movie. There was no swashbuckling archaeologist with a whip, but this quest, this search for the Ark is real. And at first, Ricca resisted linking it to the movie. I mean, it's a very different story. But after a while, he just gave in.
I don't know why in the beginning I kind of resisted it because it seems so futile now. But I think it was I wanted this to stand on its own because truth is very different from fiction, or at least I thought so at the beginning of this with this story. But as I went on into it, I realized that most of the people reading this, if not all, have seen Raiders and certainly know that version of the Ark. And the other thing that made me kind of just give up and go all in to that was all the connections that started showing up early on. And I thought, well, you know, instead of tamping this down, let's celebrate this a little bit because you can't separate just the thrill of the movie from any book about people who actually went after the Ark of the Covenant. It's just really romantic and cinematic. So I decided to say, okay, we'll make it kind of like a movie.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Brad Ricca is with us today, taking us through the story of this attempt, this real live attempt to find the Ark of the Covenant. The book is called True Raiders. Ricca first got the idea a few years ago when he was reading a biography of Jerusalem. And in it, there was this reference to the expedition. It wasn't much, only about a page or so, but It got him hooked.
And I was reading it, and it's this kind of feeling of you're reading something and you don't know if it's true or not. You don't know if it's fiction or a story. And I kind of felt like my face was melting off, like in the movie, because I couldn't believe it. Of all the stories, you know, Raiders of the Lost Ark having a historical inspiration to it, I thought this was completely no way it could possibly be true. And of course, that means it is true. So that's what started me off.
You said you in the book, you put it this way. You said you were utterly fascinated by the amazement and hope that someone had actually gone after the Ark, like that it was a thing.
Yeah, because it's not something I think the majority of us would do today. If someone sent you an email and say, hey, I know where the Ark is, let's go. But they did. And in 1909, I mean, certainly the cultural landscape and historical landscape is much different. But there's, you know, and we can look back on it and say, oh, it's kind of silly. You know, they went after the Ark. But there's also this great sense of wonder to it that I wonder that we haven't lost a little bit, that this kind of blue sky adventure that you get handed this quest and you just take off.
So tell us a little bit about the historical record that you, because you start to hunt this stuff down and what is there to go on, because in the book you describe it as a collection of sometimes incomplete sources. You have things spread out across time and space, different languages, hard to tell what you could believe and what you shouldn't believe. What was out there?
Not much. And it held up this book for a long time because it's not like you could go and any kind of normal event in history, I mean, not normal, but, you know, look to the archive and see what has been written already about it, see what the people involved wrote about it, because there was almost nothing. All I had, and it took me a long time to realize this, was I had good stuff, meaning they were first-person accounts of people who were on the expedition. But the flip side of that was they often didn't agree, and they didn't always tell a story that seemed like it could possibly be true. So I didn't know how to fit that all together. And then I finally was able to get what's called the Parker Archive, named after the leader of the expedition, Monty Parker. And this was the real historical you know, bricks and mortar of the expedition. This was expense reports and field reports and maps and you know, other things I'm sure we're going to talk about. But that was something actually real. So once I had that, I realized that the only way to tell this story anyway, I was going about it like, well, how am I going to tell a story about something real, like a piece of pottery or a work of art? But then I realized you can't tell a story about the Ark like that because we don't even know if it exists or if it ever existed. So I realized I could just let everyone in the expedition tell their own version of it and then kind of let the audience or the reader get to their own conclusion about what they believe and what they don't believe. And that made a lot of sense to me, and I'm happy the way it turned out.
You say it's not so much a history as a history of a story.
Yeah. Yeah, it was because it is. I mean, the Ark itself is a story.
Right.
The Bible itself is a story with historical, you know, real historical underpinnings to it. So that's what makes it tricky, but that's also what gives it just this great mystery to it. So yeah, I felt that once that door kind of opened up, I said, that's it, because that kind of reflects the story of the Ark itself.
What I like about you tell a little bit of kind of the backstory of getting the Parker Archive. And one of the things that I think is interesting about it is that you talked to the seventh Earl of Morley, Lord Morley. And he had first seen this archive as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
And what's interesting is he passes it over to you, but there were some, I think a family attorney, and maybe there were others who believed the papers should be kept secret because, mm-hmm. I don't know, maybe what, that it was an embarrassment for the family, or that, as someone said, it might sort of start up this international incident.
Yeah, I think part of that, and that I think I can't say for certain, because mm-hmm. he does, like you said, he witnesses, you know, he's being picked up from school as a kid, and the family lawyer, this ancient family barrister, is there, and he has this briefcase, and he tells his father, you know, these can never get out, they'll cause an international incident. And I think of some of that is sort of British embarrassment. But there's also, I think, because it's he was an earl, and there's this long tradition, and there's also a name to uphold, that part of it was, you know, just kind of embarrassment, maybe. And I think there's some financial issues too. And there's, you know, if you want to, like I said, I don't know for sure, you can always read, you know, extrapolate further and say, well, it'll cause an international incident because he took something from Jerusalem.
Yeah.
But which I didn't think was the case. But yeah, it's interesting to see how the stories get kind of passed down, not only through history, in this case, history doesn't touch this story really, but yeah. Especially through the family. You know, they didn't really know too much about it at all. So it was really great to talk to them about it. And they're all for it. You know, the current mm-hmm. Earl, I mentioned in the book, I'm from Cleveland, so I'm not up on addressing members of the peerage. So I did all this research. How do you talk to an earl? How do you address a letter? And I Zoomed with him over the pandemic, and I said, "My dear Lord Morley," which you're supposed to say. And
right.
he laughs and he says, "Call me Mark."
Yeah.
So he was terrific. So, but they're all for, you know, getting the story out. That it's this great adventure and there's nothing to be ashamed of at all in it. So I think that's just terrific.
So let's talk about how you do tell this story. You, as you put it in the book, you basically pieced together these fragments, and it's not nonfiction. I mean, you dramatize it. You imagine dialogue. You create scenes as a way of filling gaps that are there, because there are plenty of gaps.
Mm-hmm.
Talk a little bit about how you decided to do it. As you said, you treat it like a point of view. Here is Parker's point of view. Here is another point of view. Tell us why you decided to do it that way. And you, this is not. Is it historical fiction?
No.
Yeah.
I know it's not that, but beyond that, I don't really know what it is. I'm not a journalist. I'm not a historian. You know, so what I do, I have like a model. For this book, it was, like I said, once I had the sources, I used Faulkner's As I Lay Dying, which is one of my favorites, which is, you know, all the different narrators coming in. And if you've never read, it's a terrific book, you know, as they carry something across the county. And so with each chapter has a different set of sources. So though I do say, you know, and I say this in the footnotes, you know, sometimes I you know, add in dialogue or stitch together scenes, it's not nearly as kind of wholesale as I think people think it is. Mm-hmm. It's shockingly little, because what I do, though, is I'll take, like, if the person wrote a journal, and I'll sometimes change that to dialogue just to make it more, move more as a narrative. And then I'll when I say I make scenes together, it's like I know they're looking at this part of a tunnel, or they're in this part of the dig, and I'll look at kind of other sources as to what was there to kind of give us a picture, and look at photographs and weather reports. So it's kind of like a time machine without the time machine. Yeah, so a time machine would be a perfect recreation. And since that's impossible, what I try to do is the next best thing, which is try and bring in as much as I can to give a full 3D moving image. And where sometimes I add in dialogue, I'm not adding in dialogue like, you know, oh, the Huns are attacking. This is the theory of relativity 30 years earlier. No, it's stuff like hello or good morning, just to move the narrative along. So I try to tell a story with this. I know that's a big cliche, but everything's based on primary sources. And I say that a couple times with this book, and I don't say, because a lot of times you can say primary sources and that pretty much a lot of times can equal facts, but I don't think that's the case in this book. So you kind of have to, but does it get better than someone who was actually there? That's a terrific source, but then you have to think about, do I believe this person or not?
Well, that's the thing you say. You say, okay, I'm going to be as transparent as I can about the characters, about the time, about their motives, and this is how you put it in the book. You don't presume to tell readers who or what to believe. You just sort of leave that to them, I guess.
Yeah, because what I don't want to do when I write about the past is go in and kind of be part of it. So I do everything kind of from their point of view. And sometimes that can be difficult to read sometimes, but I think that's important to have. So if Monty is doing something in his chapter, he's talking about the things he's going through, the things he knows, the things he believes, and that he's written about in his letters and reports. So we just get his version. And I think I think that was important for a book about the Ark, because I think, you know, if you took a poll today, you know, is the Ark real? Will we ever find the Ark? I think you'd get wide variety of opinions. And I really wanted to explore that. And especially too, because I wrote this during the pandemic, you know, what do you believe? You know, where do you set your truth? Is it in a story, a really good story, or is it in the facts?
That's Brad Ricca. He's a lecturer at Case Western Reserve University. His book is True Raiders, the Untold Story of the 1909 Expedition to Find the Legendary Ark of the Covenant. We'll take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Utah's population is changing, but the legislature is a lot more white, male, Mormon, and Republican than the state as a whole. I'm Sonia Hudson.
And I'm Emily Means. On the latest episode of State Street, we're going behind the scenes of what it takes to run for state and local office.
I'm a woman of color. And again, it goes back to they underestimate the potential.
Find State Street wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the expedition to find the Ark of the Covenant, which sounds like a movie, which of course it is, but the real story isn't much like Raiders of the Lost Ark, except the Lost Ark part. The Raiders in the real story didn't have whips and they didn't fight the Nazis, but they did have a secret code from the Bible as their guide. Brad Ricca has written a book about all of this. It's called True Raiders. Well, let's talk about the relic at the heart of this story, the Ark of the Covenant itself. First, I wanted you to give us a thumbnail sketch about what it is. I mean, I think most people have a sense of it. We've all seen the movie, but what is it, do you think, that's so intriguing about this item?
I think it's that it shows. So it shows up in the Bible a few times. And again, I think Raiders gets it right on. They don't go, Raiders of the Lost Ark doesn't go into the actual stories, but they kind of get the basics of it right. And the Bible tells us the exact measurements of it and you know, what it's covered, what kind of wood it's made of, what it's covered in, how to hold it. You know, people, David makes mistakes with it early on and people die. It starts to fall off a horse cart and somebody grabs it so it doesn't hit the ground and God strikes him dead for simply touching the ark. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's used against Jericho. It has immense power. But there's also kind of what it's used for in secret that I found much more mysterious. Mm-hmm. In that it's used, and they say this in the movie too, as a means to communicate with God. So only the high priest could approach the ark, and there's different theories. You know, you'd wear the vest and things would glow, and you could ask yes or no questions, and the remains of the Ten Commandments might be inside. So there's just, it's loaded with arcane biblical mystery. But even more so is the fact that it disappears out of the Bible, that Jerusalem is sacked. Babylonians, you know, take everything. But then they have a convenient list of the things that they've taken from Jerusalem, from the temple, and the ark is not on the list. So that becomes, you know, this is true crime 101.
Right.
People just go bananas. It's not on the list, so where is the ark? And, of course, there's countless theories as to where it is. And I've heard many more since this book has come out. I've gotten my fair share of emails. But it's one of those things, and film people, you know, and script people say it's the ultimate MacGuffin. And biblical historians talk about it in different ways. And it's just, it has, to me, I think it has a foot in both worlds, in that it's something physical, maybe. You know, no one has seen it in thousands of years, and we don't know if anyone saw it in the first place.
Right.
But it was something physical. It was a box. And what's inside? I mean, this is the oldest mystery in the universe. You know, what's inside the box? And I think that's what gets us. That's what makes it just so tantalizing. It's not the gold, though that is the first thing that motivates the expedition. But I think what people who believe in its existence today are looking for that means of communication. And also, it's just another way of proving one's faith as being real. That it's one of those things, you know, like the true cross, or and this goes for every faith on the planet. There's different relics and artifacts. So I think it all kind of ties up in the ark.
So before we get to the actual expedition itself, let's go back just a bit, because there's this idea that the ark ends up in this underground chamber on the Temple Mount, this place where Solomon's temple was supposed to have been. And that gets us to the first character in the book, and this really gripping moment that draws us into the story, Charles Warren and this discovery. Will you take us through this part?
Yeah. So the idea is, and like you said, we'll get to it, is that the ark just never left. It was hidden away by the high priest, and remains under the Temple Mount for the rebuilding of the temple. The book starts out with Charles Warren, who's in Jerusalem before the expedition for the Ark.
Yeah.
And he was one of the first British archaeologists / raider / adventurer / writer. I mean, he's one of these people that has, you know, there's a lot of bad things about growing or living in this time period. But you could also get away with about 30 different employment options at any given time.
He investigates Jack the Ripper, for example, which is a kind of a weird twist in the story.
Yeah. Yeah. Can't make that up. But he
no.
So as much as I wish otherwise, but he was Warren was in the tunnel that will ends up being kind of the linchpin of the whole book, and it's this ancient tunnel that the story goes was used by David himself to finally win Jerusalem and start his kingdom. And Warren goes through it, and it's very dangerous. There's rising. I never thought of this, but people have complained to me. They're like, "Why did you put that in the first chapter?" Because I'm claustrophobic, and I never.
I am
thought
too,
of that.
By the way. I am
I'm
too.
Sorry.
Yeah.
I'm so sorry. It's horrifically claustrophobic. But this is, and I wanted to start out with truth, and this is taken from Warren's own. Journals and book, and this is what he did. And he went through this tunnel, and he finds things in the tunnel that suggest there are secrets there that nobody knows about. And it kind of starts the ball rolling that, if there's hidden underground tunnels here under the Temple Mount, maybe the Ark could be there too.
Yeah. Well, let's fast forward a few years then, and we get to one of the main characters, I think the main character, Monty Parker. You say in the book, Parker is the most like a cipher, and a cipher will come up here in a moment, but the most like a cipher himself in the historical record. Tell us about Monty.
Yeah, he's almost a blank space in the historical record, which is very frustrating for someone like me. He leaves very little writing behind. Very little was written about him. So it's really difficult to deal with, and at times it kind of derailed the whole project. But I've written books about people like that before. And if you have what I've found, if you have enough context around them, then the shape that you see in the middle, you can start to see. So Monty, I don't think it's, we don't learn a lot about him in this book. We know why he goes. I think there's lots of suggestions that his original motive for going changes. And we know some of the things he does and tries to do. But he's still a mystery. And then someone pointed out to me, I was kind of going on, well, I don't know anything about my main character here. And they're like, well, he's a man of mystery, isn't he? And I said, yeah. And they said, well, just leave him as is. That's more that's more enticing anyway. So he is as much as I could get. And I did find things later on in the Parker archive that really helped give him a voice. But yeah, he's a mysterious person.
Yeah. Well, tell us about the expedition itself, because Monty is sought out to lead this expedition. Tell us about the idea here, and what are the motives of this expedition?
The motive is to find the Ark, and so going after the Ark was, it's not something that everyone did, but it was kind of a thing in the early 1900s. There had just been a pretty big excavation in Ireland to find it. That was a huge failure. Yeah. So people had theories and it was something people were willing to do because whoever found it would be rich beyond imagining. And that's when we meet another member of the cast. And I promise you, I'm not making any of this up. his name was Dr. Walter Juvelius. And he was a Finnish scholar. He was first a surveyor, and then he started reading the Bible in ancient Hebrew, as one does. And he said that he found a secret code in the book of Ezekiel. And his code, he said, told him where the Ark was. And it gets its way eventually to this group of British businessmen and ex-soldiers. They call themselves the Syndicate, which is, right. Great for a writer.
So great.
And they see the code at work, And it sounds, you know, like something to dismiss, but then they see it, and the sentences that come out of it are really, you know, go 40 steps, turn right under the mountain, and you will see the fire of God. And they're just blown away by this. And they persuade Monty to go, and I think at that point, it's strictly fortune and glory that they're putting dollar signs on it or pound signs, and that's why they're gone, because they have no experience in archaeology whatsoever, but they raise money and they just go.
Well, say more about the cipher itself, because I think that it's, you tell the story of Javulius. Well, how is it Javulius?
I say Juvelius.
Juvelius. Okay, sorry.
Different ways, though. Yeah.
So you tell the story of Juvelius, how he is, I don't know, I love the backstory you tell a little bit later in the book. You talk about, you know, his father is, he goes on these long trips in the countryside, Finland, and starts to read the Bible, and he's trying to make sense of the chronology of it. And this is when he comes up with this cipher. But say a little bit more about this code, this cipher. It's this kind of equation, and it's real, right? I mean, at least it's he thinks it's real. And like, how does it work? Say something about that. It's really interesting.
So it's every seventh letter, and then you start to make sentences. And there's, like with any cipher, there's little things that change over time, where you loop around and double things, but it's basically every seventh letter. The difficulty of the cipher for someone like me, who wanted to, of course, see whether it worked or not, was he just come, because he clearly believe he changes his whole life for this cipher, puts everything on the line for this. So he clearly, I think, believed in it. And there's other, you know, things in the book on that too. But so the issue with it for someone like me is he goes through, it's not the every seventh letter, but it's also then through Swedish, and then two different types of ancient Hebrew. So to get, and that he said when he would try to explain the cipher, is that part of it too was also in his head, that he is the only one who had, so they tried to fact check it once they gave it to him, and they couldn't do it because they couldn't find someone who could do all these three things at once that he was doing in his own mind. And I started to, and I thought, you know, I could hire a biblical scholar, but I wanted to keep it at the experience of the people there. And the syndicate, and especially Monty doubted the cipher many times. And sometimes he totally believed it. So I wanted it to have that kind of is it or isn't it quality. Like, it sounds good. It's every seventh character through three languages, a few things here or there. And he shows it. I have all of Juvelius's notes on this, photocopied handwritten notes. But there's always, you know, was this a con? Is he making this up? There's something going else on, something else going on. And I think that question, like the ark itself, I wanted to let hang because it's more fun that way. But I think it's more, it speaks to their experience in a more truthful way, I think.
This expedition, as you said, there were efforts to find the ark before, and it seems like that was just kind of a thing in that era. The idea, you know, the idea of finding, and the Noah's Ark comes up. You know, the Holy Grail comes up. Just seems like that, and I wonder what you make of that. Like, the idea that these things weren't thought of as metaphors,
right?
You know, to tell a moral story in scripture, they were actual things that could be gotten, could be found, they could be treasures.
Yeah, I think you said that just so perfectly, that's what it was, because this is also the age of biblical archaeology, just the starting of it, that you could go to Jerusalem. And it's one thing to read the Bible and read the stories, but here you could see the places. You could take things that were from that time. And this is also the time of you know, Egypt too, and taking things from Egypt, taking things from Jerusalem, all bringing it back to England where you could look at it. But it was something, a thought, an idea, something abstract made real into something you can touch. So the next step of that was, just like you said, the Ark, the Grail, Noah's Ark, the true cross, Aaron's rod. There's a whole list of that people thought, you know, well, if we found this in Jerusalem, why couldn't we find the Ark?
Yeah. And you do mention in the book also that you're aware, you're writing about a treasure hunter or treasure hunters, and that this is problematic. You know, stealing relics and land and culture is something that we're aware of now. We have a clear eye about how did you work that out in terms of how you portrayed Monty and the rest of them?
Yeah, I think, that was kind of tough for me, but at the same time, not, because it was never a question that I wouldn't just show it as is. But I think it's maybe tougher for the reader, because it starts out, that's all they're looking for. I mean, they start digging and they tell the locals that they're building a school or a hospital, which is a complete lie. They're just looking for treasure. But I was able to tell some side stories in there, like Warren looking for the Moabite stone, and how, you know, there was such a race for relics at this point that people would go to violent means to get them. But also because I think at the end, near the end of the story, without giving too much away, I think Monty, I think his motives really do change. And I think there's proof of that. It's not me just like wanting him to be a better person. I think it changes for him. Is in a few of the people there, that once they get there, they can feel the weight of this place of where this happened, and it starts to kind of change their viewpoint.
Brad Ricca, his new book is True Raiders. We'll take another break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Listener support makes programming possible on KUER. You can easily manage your donation anytime with MyKUER. It's a place to go to update your contact information, find tax receipts, change the amount of your donation, or switch payment methods. For example, you can update that expired credit card with a direct donation from your bank account. Sign into your personal online donor profile at KUER.org/MyKUER.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The movie Raiders of the Lost Ark is no true story, but there really was an expedition to find this sacred antiquity that was said to contain fragments from the Ten Commandments. Brad Ricca tells the story in a new book. Ricca sifted through a collection of letters and journals and maps, and he stitched together the pieces of a story from 1909, a group of explorers called the Syndicate, who followed a secret code in the Bible to a tunnel just outside the city walls of Jerusalem. The book is called True Raiders. Let's talk about a love interest in the book. Ava Astor. I'm not sure if that's exactly the way to put it. Her connection with Monty is, you make the most of it. it's unclear exactly what there is there, but she's a great figure. Obviously, people know the name Astor anyway, and this connects us with another big story, which is the Titanic, which is just sort of another weird overlapping in this story. Yeah. But just talk a little bit about Ava and how you drew that drew her into the story. She's not featured a lot, but it's enough to be really great, I think.
It was, I couldn't, yeah, I think that's it exactly. The story was so good, I couldn't ignore it. And it's a story from gossip columns. It's not from diaries. And I say it's from, you know, they spotted her and Monty at the horse races and at this party, and they were very close in conversation. So some of that,
and she's thought of as the most beautiful woman in the
world.
That's how she's been described.
And the richest too.
And the rich.
One of the rich. But she's newly divorced. She lives in London, and it seems, according to the gossip columns, that Monty, she catches Monty's eye, which you know, she seemed to catch everyone's eye. Mm-hmm. And there's this one story where she seems to dump him. For someone who's way more accomplished, more money, et cetera. And this is right after he'd been asked to lead the expedition. And he kind of pauses and he says, well, you might not see me for a while because I'm going to go look for the Ark of the Covenant. And this is just the greatest line to give someone who just dumped you of all time, I think. and she supposedly says, well, if you find it, then come see me again, which is really terrific. So this is like so much of the stuff that we're talking about is a story. Mm-hmm. And it was reported on as absolutely true by the newspapers. But is that how the conversation went? I mean, I don't know, but it's a good story. And she doesn't. Yeah, she comes back. The other reason I really wanted to include her is I think the stuff you mentioned with the Titanic and later her daughter mm-hmm. gets involved with some things with King Tut's tomb that are just an exploring kind of conspiracy of story in this book. How speculation about how everything's could be connected. It ended up going some just really weird places. I had no idea it would. But because of the nature of that story, I said, you know, if those places show up, I'm going to explore them. So it kind of like talks about or gets to kind of parallel things that the expedition does. But yeah, she's a great story and just a terrific subject, I think.
Yeah. Well, we won't give too much away about what exactly happens. But can we say, Brad Ricca, that there becomes... There is this, international incident is a way to kind of describe what happens at the tail end of this expedition. And there's a really controversial part of this story. I'm not sure how much you want to say, but can you allude to how this expedition kind of starts to blow up in some way?
Yeah, I'd say a little bit. There is... You know, some people say, well, I know how the book ends. It's like the Titanic, you know, there's no arc. But that doesn't mean there isn't something. Mm-hmm. Near the end, like you said, there's this big international event. And one of the reasons to go back to your early questions, why I leaned into the movie is because near the end... Monty is convinced he knows where it is, and it's in a very holy place that is taboo to dig in. And what does he do? He disguises himself and his crew. They bribe the guard, and they start digging, which is exactly from Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Yeah.
So I'm like, I have to include that. So the question of what they did exactly and what they found is the end of the book, and it's a matter of speculation and the reader has to get involved. But after they leave 3 days later on the front page, the headlines of newspapers all across America and all across the world are stories about what happened. And the front page of the Times is have Englishmen found the Ark, have adventurers stolen the temple, the treasures of Solomon. I mean, this is happening all over. The story gets picked up and is run into the ground because it's, you know, the same things we were talking about earlier. This is a story that resonates with people. Mm-hmm. Did they find the Ark? You know, what did they find? What happened? So it caused, and there's riots. It causes some amount of consternation in Jerusalem, which is not the place you want to do that. So, yeah, stuff happens at the end.
Stuff happens at the end. Monty's very cagey about all of this. He doesn't admit to anything.
Yeah.
He does send this letter to the Times in London. This was in May of 1911. And we can just say that he, it's kind of interesting. He doesn't say anything. He doesn't admit to anything. It's a kind of gracefully written letter, but it's super cagey.
Yeah. I think, and that's like, as I said, he writes so little that's been preserved. Yeah. And that, I think, is the closest to something of a confession, maybe we'll call it. I won't tell you of what. But yeah, it's he was a wanted man almost at that point. Because he went from someone who was mentioned in the gossip columns to the front page of the newspapers of where is Monty Parker, because people wanted to know if he had the Ark.
Yeah. Dr. Juvelius, this was interesting. You write about how he creates his own account of the events, which you say is ostensibly a work of fiction, but talk a little bit about that. Like his account of it is in this short story that he writes. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you want to say anything. Do you mind saying something about that?
No, I think it's the most fascinating part of the book for me. Yeah. Juvelius writes some things about the expedition. The most complete thing he writes is a short story. And I thought, oh, that doesn't help me. You know, what's a short story going to do? But then you read the short story and everyone in the expedition is in it. Yeah. And all these things are happening. And he's a very, very interesting person. And he's not a narrator that I would take at face value, but I don't want that to be a, I'm not saying he's unreliable at all. I found some things that I guess Finnish fiction is heavily autobiographical or can be in a certain mode. And that it's more that some of the things he talks about in his account, and he says this is a true account of what happened in Jerusalem. And it's just loaded with stuff, with spies and, but that other people corroborate. And he also had malaria too, which affects part of it too. I don't want to give away too much of his chapters, but I really like his chapters because they're, to me, it's surreal. And you really have to think about, I mean, this is the guy who came up with the cipher and leaves his family to come dig in the sand, never having done so before. You know, what's going through, what's his version of the events? He's fascinating to me.
Do you believe there was an Ark or is an Ark? And I wonder if writing this book and learning what you did about it may have altered what you thought before about that question.
That's a great question, because I don't think going into it, you know, anyone who's ever written anything on the Ark, and then you read all these books on the Ark and that are all over the place, and there's always a part of you that say, well, maybe the research will lead somewhere. You know, maybe I'll find a gold-covered coffee table in Monty's mansion. So I think I went in like that, but I think it did change. I think that – so I have my – you know, the book was inspired too by not only Raiders of the Lost Ark, but all that kind of 80s speculative stuff. Yeah. And the good and bad in that. So I hid some things.
The in search of sort of stuff, right?
Totally in search of. Big fan of in search of. Except no Bigfoot in this one.
Right.
Because I think that speaks to today's, what's going on today. You know, do we just believe the conspiracy theory or the facts or whatever? But so I hid some things in the book. And one of the things is where I think the arc is and what I think the arc is. And it's actually the cover of the book. So I think I'll be mysterious and leave it at that. I think a story is just as powerful as a thing, if not more so. And I think that's the what the book talks about a lot. But I don't know. I think it's – I tried to write it so everyone can come up with their own version of things. Because somebody just asked me, too. They're like, well, if we find the arc, you know, would you write an epilogue? And I'm like, that'd be great. But my version, the clue is on the cover. That's all I'll say.
Perfect. Brad Ricca, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Brad Ricca, he teaches at Case Western Reserve University. His book is True Raiders, the untold story of the 1909 expedition to find the legendary Ark of the Covenant. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter at Radio West. Our intern is Stu Nolan, the program produced by Kerry Watson, by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. I'm Doug Fabrizio.